From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's show, we remember former poet laureate Philip Levine, who died Saturday at the age of 87. Heavy manual labor, the kind of work he did in Detroit as a young man, was the subject of many of his poems. He saw the factory as an exotic place.
There was fire, there was noise, it was like bedlam. I remember going into a foundry once and thinking, really, I'm in hell.
We'll listen back to our interview with him and with singer Leslie Gore. She was a teenager when she recorded the crybaby hit It's My Party. Her song You Don't Own Me became a kind of feminist anthem.
I've always hated wimpy women, so when I first heard this piece of material, I knew it was one I wanted to do.
Gore died Monday at the age of 68. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Ornette Coleman's new album, and film critic David Edelstein reviews Wild Tales from Argentina. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Philip Levine, a former U.S. poet laureate whose work often reflected the hardships and dignity of manual labor, died last Saturday at his home in Fresno, California. He was 87. Levine worked in Detroit factories as a young man, and a New York Times review once described him as a large, ironic Whitman of the industrial heartland, loyal to his roots in Detroit, determined to remember the exhausted and enraged worker, the unlucky immigrant, the man who gasps for breath and asks, "Am I going to make it?" Terry spoke to Philip Levine in 1991 when he'd published a collection of poems called What Work Is. She asked him why work had become such an important theme in his poems.
I suppose because most of my poetry originates in memory. Coleridge said that really the only thing the imagination has to work on is remembered experience. And I find this is very true in my own case. Also, my working days went from age 14, that kind of work, heavy manual labor, from age 14 to about 29. And it seems to me that I was more sensitive to the world around me. I was a learner. I was somebody with his eyes open, constantly looking for teachers. And I think as a youngster growing up in these circumstances, I was just more open to sensation, more open it's an odd word, but almost an exotic world. It was the work of automobile assembly factories, and that it's a very exotic place, or it was when I was very young. There was fire, there was noise, it was like bedlam. Sometimes I remember going into a foundry once to get a job, and I was about 17. They wouldn't hire me. I was too young, and thinking, really, I'm in hell.
Yeah,
this is
uh-huh.
like hell. You know, it was so hot, and it was this liquid metal, and I was terrified. I was glad they wouldn't hire me.
I want you to read the title poem from your new collection, What Work Is. And is there a story you'd like us to hear about the poem before we hear the poem itself?
Yeah, there is. There's a curious story. I never worked at Ford Highland Park, which I mentioned in the poem, but I went there once for a job during a period in the early 50s in Detroit when there was a kind of a slight recession, so a lot of people got laid off, although Detroit was a booming town back then. And I waited in line, and it was raining, and it was a long wait. You know, the newspaper would advertise, you know, assemblers. That's the lowest job you can get. And they would put hours down, like 8 to 5. But you knew you had to be there early if you were going to get a job. And so you got there maybe 7:30. Well, they didn't open the employment office till, say, 9. So you stood there for an hour and a half before anything even opened, and there were 50 people ahead of you. But that was in a way to, you know, they wanted to test you. You know, how much crap could you take? Were you willing to wait in line that long? If you weren't, they didn't want you. And so as I waited, I grew angrier and angrier at myself for being this humble character. And finally, maybe about 10:30 or so, I got up to the head of the line. And there was a guy sitting down. I was standing. We each went to a different desk. We stood, they sat. And he said, "What kind of job would you like?" And I don't know where this impulse came from, but I said, "I want your job."
Oh, gee.
And he said, "Okay, take off." And that was it. But I was sort of happy that there was this thing in me that was still there that, you know, said, you know, "I don't want you and you don't want me." And so I suppose that I never forgot that moment of standing there all that time and then being, you know, a smart mouth.
Did you have the money to afford to mouth off like that and lose the pay for the day?
No. No, I didn't. I remember I went to Chevrolet Gear and Axle, which was an awful place, later that day and got another got a job there, which was just as bad, you know, it was just as bad a place. I was married at the time. I had to make a living. I had responsibilities. I really couldn't afford to be who I wanted to be. Yeah. Let me read the poem. What work is? We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Ford Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting, shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision, until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course it's someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead, a man is waiting who will say, "No, we're not hiring today," for any reason he wants. You love your brother. Now suddenly you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind or ahead, because he's home, trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him, held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide and said those words, and maybe kissed his cheek? You've never done something so simple, so obvious. Not because you're too young or too dumb, not because you're jealous or even mean or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No, just because you don't know what work is.
When did you start writing about your experiences in factories? Were you still in factories when you were writing poems?
I was unable to write any poetry about my working life while that was my working life. I tried a few times, and the poems were hysterical. I think they were just, you know, I couldn't control them. My anger was so overwhelming that I couldn't cope with it. Just as I couldn't write about my boyhood very effectively until I was 40. It was still too powerful for me. But I'm patient, so I hung in there, and that's probably my chief virtue as a writer, is my patience. So I waited, and I kept trying to write about factory work, but I kept throwing the poems away. And the first poem I ever published about working in a factory, I was, 31 or 2, but I don't like the poem anymore.
Can you give me a sense of what was going wrong in the factory poems when you were still there? Is there anything?
Yes, okay. Yes, I can. The language was overblown. I wanted to use the word eternity, and, you know, I wanted to use a kind of Latin diction, almost a Miltonic diction, and a great chorus, build up a great chorus of sound, and to dramatize the horror show of some of the places I'd worked. And I didn't have any, there was no tenderness in it for the people that I worked with. There was no, that was part of the reward that I got for those years, was the people I was meeting, even though you didn't talk to them that much because the places were often so loud. But you'd meet them afterwards, or you'd make friends with them and spend time with them. And they weren't getting in the poems at all. The poems were, you know, my poor soul being hammered out of shape by General Motors. And they were a bit self-indulgent. <yeah. laughs>
Philip Levine speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1991. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're listening to Terry's interview with former U.S. Poet Laureate Philip Levine, who died last Saturday. Many of his poems were about manual labor.
What was your final goodbye to factory work?
My final goodbye was, it came when my first wife left me, which is why I always love the word goodbye. And I didn't have to do this. Also, I wasn't in debt, and it just suddenly occurred to me, she's gone. I don't owe anybody anything. I'm going to quit. I'm going to live on my wits, or try. And so I started to try to live on my wits, and sure enough, I've done it.
So what did
that...
Not too well
all the time, but, you know.
When you decided to live on your wits, where did you go? What did you do for money?
Well, actually, I took a job with my brother. I don't want to describe it because he'd get mad at me. And for a long summer, and I could live like a little church mouse. And then I went off to the University of Iowa to study poetry writing with Robert Lowell. And I thought there was a fellowship there for me. And when I got there, I was a year late, and the fellowship had been given to somebody else, even though I'd written them and said, hold it for me. And so I never registered. I just took courses without paying for them and kept saying, oh, that information will get to you soon. And I studied with Robert Lowell and then John Berryman. And John Berryman was a great teacher, just a great teacher. And I never needed another teacher after that. So I had a year of studying with two terrific poets. Not living particularly well. Then I met my second wife. She wasn't my wife when I met her. She was just a lucky single woman. And we got married, and my wife worked for a while. When our second child came, I started teaching then. And by this time, I'd published enough poetry to get a job teaching. And I'd finished a master's degree through the Mayo from Wayne University. So I lucked in there. I got this terrific woman. I mean, she's not just that she supported me. She's also a marvelous woman. I'm still married to her. Thank God. She hasn't abandoned me.
You've written a lot of poems that... where your brother figures into the poem?
Yeah.
Do you see your brother as, like, the alternate version of your life or something? You know, like somebody who you could have been and you're not? Or, I mean, like, what function do you see your brother as serving almost as metaphor or something within your poems?
Yeah, you know, first thing, I'm an identical twin.
Ah.
And I didn't realize how significant this was in my poetry. I have a great many poems in which men have these encounters with each other in a couple of poems in which they embrace very deeply, they hold each other. And I think that a lot of that... I remember a guy writing, a wonderful man named David Calstone, who's dead now, writing a review of one of my books and talking about these encounters and how powerful they were, or how powerful he felt they were. And it was that review that opened my eyes to the fact that, of course, the roots of that are that the terrible wrenching away from my twin brother. I grew up half believing I was half a person. It's very curious to grow up as an identical twin. Not sure that I was the whole person. Maybe I was. Me and him both, or me, you know, it's very difficult to describe, but I don't think since I was five I've ever felt, you know, that anything as close as I'd felt up to that time, maybe six or seven, when we began to drift apart. And I remember when I first started writing poetry, it was enormously, I was about, oh, I don't know. Well, actually, I didn't show my brother the first poems I wrote. I didn't show him poems until I was about 17 or so. And he loved them. He just loved them. And he would take, he's a bigger guy than I, and he's more aggressive physically and in every other way. And he would take these poems and show them to people and say, what do you think? Isn't this great? That's what he would say. Isn't this great? And of course they'd say, yeah, because he was kind of an intimidating guy. My brother's a great poet. And in some ways it was the high point of my writing career. I mean, I had one reader and he was absolutely mad for what I was doing. Now I have many more readers, but I don't know if any of them, you know, are so totally, totally taken with what I write. I was really writing totally for two people, myself and my brother. Since then I've discovered others but it was quite amazing.
You said that you were wrenched away from your twin brother. When were you wrenched away?
I was afraid you'd ask that. I just felt at a certain point in my life that when I was quite young, that I had to be myself. I began to make discoveries about him, that he wasn't me. There were ways in which he reacted to experiences. I could see that it was they just weren't my reactions. And so a time came when I said, I can't go on with this. I have to find out my own identity and live it. And so I suppose the wrenching was something I imposed upon myself. My guess is he probably felt something similar. I do think there were times when our inmost thoughts were communicated to each other without our speaking. We were that close.
I want to get back to something you said early in the interview.
Sure.
You said that, then this is when you were, you know, waiting online for factory jobs and knowing that you might get turned down. You said you couldn't afford to be who you wanted to be. And I think within that sentence is a pretty interesting class analysis about identity. You know what I mean? That it takes a certain amount of money in a way to live, not only to live the life you want, but to be who you want to be.
That's right. That's right. I mean, for example, I was politically very conscious. I was aware of exploitation. I remember my brother and I at about age 10 swearing we would never exploit other people. We would never live off the labor of other people, you know, in a way in which they were abused and we were given an advantage on their hard work. And I remember when I worked for a General Motors factory once, you had to take these IQ tests before you started working. And they said, you know, we'd like to put you into our management program. You've done very well on this IQ test. I lied and said I'd never gone to college or they'd never hire you. And they said, gee, these scores are wonderful. And I said, no. And they said, we would send you to Flint, Michigan. You go to a school there. You know, we have a slavery school there. You know, you'll be taught really how to torture people effectively and subtly. And we'll pay you twice as much, and when you're done, we'll give you a suit and a tie. Wouldn't you like to do that? I said, no, I just like to be a slave myself. I mean, I didn't like being a slave, but I had taken an oath that I wasn't going to exploit people. And my brother was watching me. I couldn't break it. He's a very stubborn guy. And so it was a determination we made. It would be nice to be able to afford it. Of course, then what do you have to do? You have to change the world so that lots of people can take that oath and live it, right? And how did I choose to change the world so that was more possible? I wrote poetry. And I actually thought, and this will strike you, Terry, as idiotic.
I actually thought that
writing poetry would be a means of changing the world because what I was reading was changing me so radically. Nothing in my life had as much power over me as what I read, both poetry and fiction. And when I began, too, I wanted to be a novelist as well as a poet. Then, of course, when I published my first book in an edition of 220, I said to myself, gee whiz, this is a big country for 220 books.
Would you feel that in some ways poetry is obsolete for a lot of people because they have movies and TV and songs to tell their stories.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. By this time, I didn't care, because by this time, I had fallen in love with the poem, and I loved writing it, and I didn't care. I mean, it was what I had to do, and whether it changes people or whether it doesn't, it's what I have to do.
Philip Levine, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's nice. It's a pleasure.
Former U.S. Poet Laureate Philip Levine speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. Levine died last Saturday. He was 87. After a break, we'll remember singer Leslie Gore, who died Monday. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Ornette Coleman's new album, New Vocabulary, which Kevin says has a lightning-in-a-bottle quality. And David Edelstein reviews the Argentinian film Wild Tales. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Netflix, presenting its original series House of Cards about ruthless DC power couple Frank and Claire Underwood, starring Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright. Seasons 1 and 2 are now streaming. All new episodes of Season 3 premiere on Friday, February 27th on Netflix. And from Progressive Insurance, with its APRON project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The great jazz saxophonist Ornette Coleman is now 84 and rarely makes records anymore. His last album, Sound Grammar, won the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 2007. Now, with no fanfare, comes a new indie release recorded in 2009 that finds Coleman in unfamiliar company. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has the story and a review.
In a way, New Vocabulary is like no other Ornette Coleman record, with its singular lineup of alto saxophone, trumpet, and drums, with the trumpeter doubling on electronics. In another way, it's like every Ornette record, because his sound is unmistakable. As always, Coleman peppers his solos with pet phrases as catchy as a children's song or earthy as a field holler. Thank you. Ornette's early hero, Charlie Parker, had his favorite licks too, and his example taught Coleman to write tunes that sound like the way he plays. Then those written figures seep back into the improvising in an endless loop. Coleman's lines on New Vocabulary echo tunes from all over his career. This music has a backstory. In 2008, Ornette Coleman had met trumpeter Jordan McLean of the Brooklyn Afro-funk band Antibalas. They started jamming, and they liked it even more when McLean brought along drummer Amir Ziv. Over a period of months, their jams turned into rehearsals as pieces began to take shape out of their improvising. They recorded for 3 days in 2009, sometimes adding pianist Adam Holtzman as a wild card. Then McLean and Ziv did the editing and mixing. Ornette Coleman usually records with members of his own circle in settings where he has greater control. New Vocabulary takes him into a different sonic space. It's very much a cooperative project, but McLean and Ziv are generous in setting Coleman up to do what he does best. They drape backdrops behind him, but also give him plenty to respond to. It's a tricky balance to interact without interrupting. I like this scrappy music quite a bit. Trumpeter McLean fine-tunes the textures, using electronics like a flexible paintbrush. Drummer Ziv often goes easy on the cymbals for a dry, low-to-the-ground sound, leaving the higher ranges to the horns. Sometimes they're tight, but they can give each other so much room they'll seem to operate independently without clashing. The music is open but keeps moving, and Ornette and company aren't afraid to cut things short. Tracks average around 3 or 4 minutes. Fluid structures and quirky instrumentation give New Vocabulary an elusive, lightning-in-a-bottle quality. The trio feels less like a band than a temporary alliance. Jordan McLean and Amir Ziv still hang with Ornette Coleman sometimes, but nowadays they're more apt to play pool. As always, when tangling with Ornette, they gotta bring their A game.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed Ornette Coleman's new album, New Vocabulary. Coming up, we remember singer Leslie Gore, who died Monday. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing online access to ratings and reviews of local companies to help consumers achieve their home improvement goals, whether that be a remodeled kitchen, a freshly painted house, or a new backyard. Learn more at angieslist.com. And from Viking River Cruises, sailing through the heart of cities in Europe, Russia, and Asia. Viking River Cruises, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at vrc.com.
This is Fresh Air.
Sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows. Everything that's wonderful is what I feel when we're together. Brighter than a lucky penny. When you're near, the rain goes, disappears, dear, and I feel so fine just to know that you are mine. My life is sunshine.
We're going to remember singer Leslie Gore, who died Monday at the age of 68. Born Leslie Sue Goldstein in Brooklyn, she started singing as a teenager and had several hits before she was 18. She stayed in school, though, and got her degree in American Literature from Sarah Lawrence College. After her teen hit years, Leslie Gore began writing songs and performed in musical theater, television, and eventually in concerts on the nostalgia circuit. And she kept recording music. Her last album, Ever Since, was released in 2005, the year she came out as a lesbian. Before she died of lung cancer, she was working on a memoir and a Broadway show based on her life. Everyone who listened to Top 40 radio in the 60s knew Leslie Gore's hits. Judy's Turn to Cry, She's a Fool, You Don't Own Me, That's the Way Boys Are, and, of course, her first hit, It's My Party, which was produced by Quincy Jones. It was one of the big pop records he produced long before the Michael Jackson days. We'll hear Terry's interview with Leslie Gore in a couple of minutes, but first, let's hear the story of how her first hit came about. This is from Terry's 2001 interview with producer Quincy Jones.
During that time, I was recording all the divas and, you know, Nina Simone and Sarah Vaughan and Shirley Horn, Dinah Washington, and we were doing things with Robert Farn, big string, expensive dates and so forth. And they were beautiful musical albums. But Irving said to me one time, he says, you know, all the pop guys are saying you and Hal Mooney, who are the arrangers, are budget busters because you do all this big music. But we need some more help with the bottom line with hit records. And I was a little presumptuous and said, well, I don't think it's such a big deal to make a pop hit. And he says, well, why don't you start making something then? And we were at a meeting at the Oxford House where we had our A&R meetings regularly in Chicago. And he said, here's a tape that Joe Glazer sent me, and his friend, a fight manager, somebody, has a niece that sang something. Just say you listen to it and we'll send it back, you know. I grabbed it, and I said I'd like to try this because she had a great sound as far as a rock singer in those days. She could sing really in tune. She was 16 years old. And we went back to New York and talked to Joe Glazer, and he said, make her a star, and, you know, all of that Hollywood stuff. And we went in on a Saturday and recorded two songs, It's My Party, and with a B-side written by Paul Anka, young Paul Anka, called Danny. And on the way to Carnegie Hall, I saw Phil Spector. And Phil Spector said, I just cut a smash, man, with the Crystals. Called It's My Party. I said, what? I had never experienced that kind of competition before. I went back to the studio with the engineer, and we mastered 100 acetates to send out to the radio. And the rest, you know, I had to go to Japan right after that. And I told Leslie, we've got the great record and everything. All we need to do is fix that name, because I don't think this name is going to work with a pop record, you know. So
you didn't like the name Gore?
No, I didn't like it.
I won't tell Al Gore about that.
And Tipper. And so I went to Japan to do a television show, and we did a little acting and scoring it. And so I got a call from Irving Green later, and he said, did anybody call you yet? I said, no. I said, did she get that name together yet? Did she come up with any suggestions? And she said, the record's number one. Do you really care? I said, no.
Whatever happened to the Crystals recording of It's My Party that Phil Spector was producing?
I don't think it came out. Leslie's thing had such impact. I don't know. I may be wrong, but I don't think it came out.
That's Quincy Jones speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. Before we hear Terry's 1991 interview with Leslie Gore, Here's that number one hit.
It's my party, and I cry if I want to. Cry if I want to. Cry if I want to. You would cry too if it happened to you. Nobody knows where my Johnny has gone, but Judy left the same time. Why was he holding her hand when he's supposed to be mine?
In Ms. Magazine, there was recently a piece with you and K.D. Lang having a conversation with each other.
Yes.
And you said that when you were a kid, you'd sing in front of the mirror and you'd slick back your hair like Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
But when you finally walked out on stage in the spring of 1963, you went dressed like a nice little girl and performed as you were expected to.
Mm-hmm.
Can you compare what you wanted to look like when you started to performing with how you ended up looking?
Well, you know, I still basically have a very, I'm very sound-oriented. Image, which has become a major part of our business, is not what I would call my primary interest. So what it was really was sort of this, and you can probably relate, let's say you had a party to go to, and I might compare it to having the Ed Sullivan Show to do. I would say to my mother or my cousin, what do you think I should wear? And we would, you know, then go shopping for something we thought was appropriate. Because the only influence on my life at that time was my mother, I very often walked out looking sort of like my mini mother. you know, you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I didn't have anyone saying to me, just put on a pair of jeans and a white shirt, which probably would have felt comfortable to me at the time, but I probably would have had a problem with it, because I did believe you get up on stage and you dress up because there are lots of people there and it's important, and you want to show yourself off to your best advantage. I'm a little bit more savvy now in terms of image, but at 16, you don't necessarily have a clear-cut image of yourself.
Well, if you're going shopping with your mother for performances, you're not going to end up looking like the Ronettes. You know?
Exactly, exactly.
So what do you remember of that first recording session when you made It's My Party?
Hmm. Well, the first thing I remember, which is so different from today, is we recorded 4-track. This meant that we had 2 microphones basically hanging in the studio, strategically placed over the band. We had a 3rd microphone in the center of all of the background singers, and there were about 8 of them, and then I was in a little booth, and that was the 4th mic. So that was pretty much the setup. When we counted off, you heard everything that was going to be there. Today we layer a lot and we track a lot. Then you just went in and did it. When you walked out of the studio, you were pretty well mixed and knew exactly what everything sounded like.
We're listening back to an interview with singer Leslie Gore, who died on Monday. She was on Fresh Air in 1991 during a run at the Rainbow and Stars nightclub. Her cabaret act included Gershwin, Porter, and also some of the top 40 songs that made her famous, including this one, a song that made Gore, as the New Yorker put it, pop music's original teen feminist.
At the time, I know I chose it because I liked the strength in the lyric. But for me, it was not a song about being a woman. It was a song about being a person and what was involved with that. Of course, it got picked up as an anthem for women, which makes me very proud. And today, when I sing that song, I don't know, maybe it's after the Anita Hill hearings and a number of other things that have seem to be happening in our world, You Don't Own Me takes on a whole other set of meanings for me now.
Yeah, I know a lot of people have come to see it as a proto-feminist anthem.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't think of it that way when you were recording it?
I didn't. What I was impressed with was the strength. I've always hated Wimpy Woman. I've never understood it. So when I first heard this piece of material, I knew it was one I wanted to do.
Let me play something that's from the 60s, from an album called My Town, My Guy and Me. And this is a standard. This is a Julie Stein, Sammy Kahn song called The Things We Did Last Summer. Was it your idea to do a standard on this? I want to show a different side of your singing.
Probably. You know, the very first album that Quincy and I did together, we had to base it on It's My Party, but we had to throw it together quite quickly, and it was called I'll Cry If I Want To, and it was all cry songs. It was Cry Me a River. It was the Johnny Ray's cry. So we had established a premise early on, whereby I would do standards, maybe with just a slight rock and roll edge. But by and large, I don't think of The Things We Did Last Summer as a rock piece. We did it, I think, just because I loved the song. I believe Don Costa did the arrangement, and a superlative one.
Okay, let's hear it. I think we'll hear a different side of your singing.
Sure.
The boat rides we would take, the moonlight on the lake, the way we danced and hummed our favorite song. The things we did last summer, I'll remember all winter long. The midway and the fun, the Cupid dolls we won, the bell you rang to prove that you were strong. The things we did last summer, I'll remember all winter long. The early morning hike and the rented tandem bike, the lunches that we to pack. Oh, we never could.
Leslie Gore, do you know what's become of Susan Michaels, who was the president of the Leslie Gore fan club?
Yes, I do. Susan Michaels was an amalgam of my middle name, which is Sue, and my brother's first name, which is Michael. And it was actually my grandma, my Nana, who is no longer with us, who became Susan Michaels and would try to answer all the fan mail personally and handwritten. And that's who Susan Michaels is.
Oh, that's great. Well, Leslie Gore, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
The things we did last summer,
Leslie Gore spoke with Terry Gross in 1991. She died Monday at the age of 68. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the Argentinian film Wild Tales. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. One of this year's Academy Awards nominees for Best Foreign Language Film is Wild Tales, an Argentinian film containing 6 short stories. It was co-produced by filmmaker Pedro Almodovar. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
I'm guessing that the oldest subject in literature isn't love or war or the struggle for survival, but revenge. Someone takes something from you, makes you feel small, and you take it back in righteousness and blood. Now comes a frequently marvelous 6-part movie from Argentina called Wild Tales that stares hard at the subject from different angles, among them ghoulish comedy, social tragedy, gory macho farce, and feminist melodrama. In Spanish, the title is Relatos Salvajes, Savage Tales, but under either name, the takeaway is clear. Ultra-civilized humans can turn in an instant into blindingly destructive forces of nature. The writer-director, Damien Cifron, doesn't so much tell these stories as spring them on you, like jack-in-the-boxes, as in the brief pre-credits story in which a young female model, an older, flirtatious male classical music critic, makes small talk on a plane. It's hard to believe that anything savage can come from this sedate, humdrum setting, that in a few minutes the audience will be screaming in disbelief. Another tale of a yuppie in his fancy Audi who gets into a road rage duel with a man in a pickup, that's familiar in its thrust and its boys-will-be-boys silliness. But the way the one-upmanship escalates, juxtaposed with soothing music from the Audi stereo, has a logic that makes you both appalled and fascinated. People, well, men for the most part, kill each other every day over slights this stupid. I wasn't as surprised by a middle story in which a demolitions engineer begins on a note of mastery, artfully bringing down an enormous building, and is therefore relentlessly emasculated, chiefly by an indefatigable towing company. But this is the purest tale, the one that distills the mad-as-hell vigilante genre that's fueled American cinema since at least the days of Charles Bronson in Death Wish. This man's reclaiming a power with dynamite is a satisfying but simple-minded end. 2 other savage tales especially linger in the mind. The most sobering begins with a rich, drunk teenager who stumbles sniveling into his parents' bedroom to say he's run over a woman. With discovery inevitable, the father and his high-priced attorney-slash-fixer enter into a series of negotiations to pay his longtime gardener to take the blame, the money going to the gardener's impoverished family. The revenge thread comes late, and the story has a sting in its tail. The effect is to rupture our sense of complacency after the previous story, where dynamite solves everything. The final tale, Till Death Do Us Part, is the big crowd-pleaser, the one that's launched a new international star in Erica Rivas as the movie's only female protagonist. She's Ramina, the bride at a glitzy disco ball Jewish wedding, who discovers, by deduction, that her husband has had an affair with a gorgeous co-worker, who's also a guest. Given Ramina's total loss of control, I wouldn't call the subsequent frenzy a female empowerment saga. But she uses tools in her feminine arsenal, her sexuality, her ability to reduce her mama's boy husband to a sobbing, puking wreck, and her carry-at-the-prom-like fury. The movie is jam-packed with delights, one catharsis after the next, and acted by a cast that is, given the general outlandishness, incredibly credible. I wouldn't call any of Wild Tales' tales profound. Apart from the one about the rich people and the gardener, they go down too easily. They're fast food. But maybe that easiness is what's profound. It's written in the Bible, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." But with cleverness and style, director Damien Cifron sums up humans' response since time immemorial. Sorry, Lord, only chumps wait for that.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine, and he'll be live blogging the Academy Awards this Sunday at vulture.com. On Monday's show, I'll be speaking with Native American writer David Troyer. His new novel, Prudence, is set in the 1940s on a Native American reservation in Minnesota, where the government's built a camp for German prisoners of war. He'll talk about the book, his family, and his own life on the reservation. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Wix.com, giving business owners the ability to create their own website with the drag-and-drop builder. Wix.com is used by 50 million people. Learn more at Wix.com. And from Athena Health, committed to helping physicians manage industry change and transition to ICD-10 by the October 2015 deadline. More about cloud-based EHR and practice management services at athenahealth.com.